Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two stories by O. Henry, The Ransom of Red Chief and The Marquis and Miss Sally. Henry worked a number of different jobs, from pharmacy to drafting, journalism, and banking. Banking in particular was not to be O. Henry's calling. He was quite careless with his bookkeeping, fired by the bank, and charged with embezzlement in 1894. He was sentenced and served in federal prison in Ohio for 5 years, from 1898 to 1902. He was always a lover of classic literature, and while pursuing his many ventures, O. Henry had begun writing as a hobby. When he lost his banking position, he moved to Houston in 1895 and started writing for the Post, earning $25 a month. An average salary at this time in American history was probably about $300 a year. O. Henry collected ideas for his column by loitering in hotel lobbies and observing and talking to people there. He relied on this technique to gain creative inspiration throughout his writing career. And now, The Ransom of Red Chief by O. Henry. It looked like a good thing, but wait till I tell you. We were down south in Alabama, Bill Driscoll and myself, when this kidnapping idea struck us. It was, as Bill afterward expressed it, during a moment of temporary mental apparition, but we didn't find that out till later. There was a town down there, as flat as a flannel cake, and called Summit, of course. It contained inhabitants of as undeleterious and self-satisfied a class of peasantry as ever clustered around a maypole. Bill and me had a joint capital of about $600, and we needed just $2,000 more to pull off a fraudulent town lot scheme in western Illinois with. We talked it over on the front steps of the hotel. Philoprogenitiveness, says we, is strong in semi-rural communities. Therefore, and for other reasons, a kidnapping project ought to do better there than in the radius of newspapers that send reporters out in plain clothes to stir up talk about such things. We knew that Summit couldn't get after us with anything stronger than constables, and maybe some lackadaisical bloodhounds and a diatribe or two in the weekly farmer's budget. So, it looked good. We selected for our victim the only child of a prominent citizen named Ebenezer Dorset. The father was respectable and tight, a mortgage fancier, and a stern, upright collection plate passer and forecloser. The kid was a boy of 10, with baize relief freckles and hair the color of the cover of a magazine you buy at the newsstand when you want to catch a train. Bill and me figured that Ebenezer would melt down for a ransom of $2,000 to a cent. But wait till I tell you. About 2 miles from the summit was a little mountain covered with a dense cedar brake. On the rear elevation of this mountain was a cave. There we stored provisions. One evening after sundown, we drove a buggy past old Dorset's house. The kid was in the street, throwing rocks at a kitten on the opposite fence.
"Hey, little boy," says Bill. "Would you like to have a bag of candy and a nice ride?"
The boy catches Bill neatly in the eye with a piece of brick.
"Well, that will cost the old man an extra $500, says Bill, climbing over the wheel.
That boy put up a fight like a welterweight cinnamon bear. But at last we got him down in the bottom of the buggy and drove away. We took him up to the cave, and I hitched the horse in the cedar brake. After dark, I drove the buggy to the little village 3 miles away where we had hired it and walked back to the mountain. Bill was pasting court plaster over the scratches and bruises on his features. There was a fire burning behind the rock at the entrance of the cave, and the boy was watching a pot of boiling coffee with two buzzard tail feathers stuck in his red hair. He points a stick at me when I come up and says,
"Hey, cursed paleface, do you dare enter the camp of Red Chief, the terror of the plains?"
"Oh, he's all right," says Bill,
rolling up his trousers and examining some bruises on his shins.
"We were playing Indian. We're making Buffalo Bill's show look like magic lantern views of Palestine in the town hall. I'm old Hank, the trapper. Red Chief's captive, and I'm to be scalped at daybreak.
By Geronimo, that kid can kick hard.
Yes, sir, that boy seemed to be having the time of his life. The fun of camping out in a cave had made him forget that he was a captive himself. He immediately christened me Snake Eye the Spy, and announced that when his braves returned from the warpath, I was to be broiled at the stake at the rising of the sun. Then we had supper, and he filled his mouth full of bacon and bread and gravy, and began to talk. He made a during-dinner speech something like this.
I like this fine. I never camped out before, but I had a pet possum once, and I was 9 last birthday. I hate to go to school. Rats ate up 16 of Jimmy Talbot's aunt's speckled hen's eggs. Are there real Indians in these woods? I want some more gravy. Does the trees moving make the wind blow? We had 5 puppies. What makes your nose so red, Hank? My father has lots of money. Are the stars hot? I whipped Ed Walker twice Saturday. I don't like girls. You dasn't catch toads unless with a string. Do oxen make any noise? Why are oranges round? Have you got beds to sleep on in this cave? Amos Murray's got 6 toes. A parrot can talk, but a monkey or fish can't. How many does it take to make 12?
Every few minutes he would remember that he was a pesky redskin and pick up his stick rifle and tiptoe to the mouth of the cave to rubber for the scouts of the hated paleface. Now and then he would let out a war whoop that made old Hank the Trapper shiver. That boy had Bill terrorized from the start.
Red Chief, says I to the kid, would you like to go home? Aw, what for? Says he. I don't have any fun at home. I hate to go to school. I like to camp out. You won't take me back home again, Snake Eye, will you?
Well, not right away, says I. We'll stay here in the cave a while.
All right, says he. That'll be fine. I never had such fun in my life.
We went to bed about 11 o'clock. We spread down the wide blankets and quilts and put Red Chief between us. We weren't afraid he'd run away. He kept us awake for 3 hours, jumping up and reaching for his rifle and screeching,
"Hist, pard!"
in mine and Bill's ears, as the fancied crackle of a twig or the rustle of a leaf revealed to his young imagination the stealthy approach of the outlaw band. At last, I fell into a troubled sleep and dreamed that I had been kidnapped and chained to a tree by a ferocious pirate with red hair. Just at daybreak, I was awakened by a series of awful screams from Bill. They weren't yells or howls or shouts or whoops or yawps, such as you'd expect from a manly set of vocal organs. They were simply indecent, terrifying, humiliating screams, such as women emit when they see ghosts or caterpillars. It's an awful thing to hear a strong, desperate fat man scream incontinently in a cave at daybreak. I jumped up to see what the matter was. Red Chief was sitting on Bill's chest, with one hand twined in Bill's hair. In the other he had the sharp case knife we used for slicing bacon, and he was industriously and realistically trying to take Bill's scalp, according to the sentence that had been pronounced upon him the evening before. I got the knife away from the kid and made him lie down again. But from that moment, Bill's spirit was broken. He laid down on his side of the bed, but he never closed an eye again in sleep as long as that boy was with us. I dozed off for a while, but along towards sunup, I remembered that Red Chief had said I was to be burned at the stake at the rising of the sun. I wasn't nervous or afraid. But I sat up and lit my pipe and leaned against a rock.
"What you getting up so soon for, Sam?" asked Bill.
"Me?" says I. "Oh, I got a kind of pain in my shoulder. I thought sitting up would rest it."
"You're a liar," says Bill. "You're afraid. You was to be burned at sunrise, and you was afraid he'd do it. And he would, too, if he could find a match. Ain't it awful, Sam? Do you think anybody will pay out money to get a little imp like that back home?"
"Sure," said I. "A rowdy kid like that is just the kind that parents dote on. Now, you and the chief get up and cook breakfast, while I go on top of this mountain and reconnoiter."
I went up on the peak of the little mountain and ran my eye over the contiguous vicinity. Over toward Summit, I expected to see the sturdy yeomanry of the village, armed with scythes and pitchforks, beating the countryside for the dastardly kidnappers. But what I saw was a peaceful landscape dotted with one man plowing with a dun mule. Nobody was dragging the creek. No couriers dashed hither and yon, bringing tithings of no news to the distracted parents. There was a sylvan attitude of somnolent sleepiness pervading that section of the external outward surface of Alabama that lay exposed to my view. Perhaps, says I to myself, it has not yet been discovered that the wolves have borne away the tender lambkin from the fold. Heaven help the wolves, says I, and I went down the mountain to breakfast. When I got to the cave, I found Bill backed up against the side of it, breathing hard, and the boy threatened to smash him with a rock half as big as a coconut.
He put a red-hot boiled potato down my back, explained Bill, and then he mashed it with his foot. I boxed his ears. Have you got a gun about you, Sam?
I took the rock away from the boy and kind of patched up the argument.
I'll fix you, says the kid to Bill. No man ever yet struck the Red Chief but what he got paid for it. You better beware.
After breakfast, the kid takes a piece of leather with strings wrapped around it out of his pocket and goes outside the cave, unwinding it.
What's he up to now?
Says Bill anxiously.
You don't think he'll run away, do you, Sam?
No fear of it, says I.
He don't seem to be much of a homeboy, but we've got to fix up some plan about the ransom. There don't seem to be much excitement around Summit on account of his disappearance, but maybe they haven't realized yet that he's gone. His folks may think he's spending the night with Aunt Jane or one of the neighbors. Anyhow, he'll be missed today. Tonight, we must get a message to his father demanding the $2,000 for his return. Just then, we heard a kind of war whoop, such as David might have emitted when he knocked out the champion, Goliath. It was a sling that Red Chief had pulled out of his pocket, and he was whirling it around his head. I dodged and heard a heavy thud and a kind of a sigh from Bill, like a horse gives out when you take his saddle off. A rock the size of an egg had caught Bill just behind his left ear. He loosened himself all over and fell on the fire across the frying pan of hot water for washing the dishes. I dragged him out and poured cold water on his head for half an hour. By and by, Bill sits up and feels behind his ears and says,
Sam, do you know who my favorite biblical character is?
Take it easy, says I. You'll come to your senses presently.
King Herod, says he. You won't go away and leave me here alone, will you, Sam?
I went out and caught that boy and shook him until his freckles rattled. If you don't behave, says I, I'll take you straight home. Now, are you going to be good or not?
I was only funnin', says he, sullenly. I didn't mean to hurt old Hank, but what'd he hit me for? Oh, behave, Snake Eye, if you won't send me home, and if you'll let me play the Black Scout today.
I don't know the game, says I. That's for you and Mr. Bill to decide. He's your playmate for the day. I'm going away for a while on business. Now you come in and make friends with him and say you are sorry for hurting him, or home you go at once. I made him and Bill shake hands, and then I took Bill aside and told him I was going to Poplar Cove, a little village 3 miles from the cave, and find out what I could about how the kidnapping had been regarded in Summit. Also, I thought it best to send a peremptory letter to old Mr. Dorset that day, demanding the ransom and dictating how it should be paid.
You know, Sam, says Bill, I've stood by you without batting an eye in earthquakes and fire and flood, in poker games, dynamite outrages, police raids, train robberies, and cyclones. I never lost my nerve yet till we kidnapped that two-legged skyrocket of a kid. He's got me going. You won't leave me long with him, will you, Sam?
I'll be back sometime this afternoon, says I. You must keep the boy amused and quiet till I return. And now we'll write the letter to old Dorset. Bill and I got paper and pencil and worked on the letter while Red Chief, with a blanket wrapped around him, strutted up and down, guarding the mouth of the cave. Bill begged me tearfully to make the ransom $1,500 instead of $2,000.
"I ain't attempting," says he, "to decry the celebrated moral aspect of parental affection, but we're dealing with humans, and it ain't human for anybody to give up $2,000 for that 40-pound chunk of freckled wildcat. I'm willing to take a chance on $1,500. You can charge the difference up to me."
So, to relieve Bill, I acceded, and we collaborated a letter that ran this way. "Ebenezer Dorset, Esquire. We have your boy concealed in a place far from Summit. It is useless for you or the most skilled detectives to attempt to find him. Absolutely, the only terms on which you can have him restored to you are these. We demand $1,500 in large bills for his return, the money to be left at midnight tonight at the same spot and in the same box as your reply, as hereinafter described. If you agree to these terms, send your answer in writing by a solitary messenger tonight at 8:30. After crossing Owl Creek on the road to Poplar Cove, there are 3 large trees about 100 yards apart, close to the fence of the wheat field on the right-hand side. At the bottom of the fence post, opposite the 3rd tree, will be found a small pasteboard box. The messenger will place the answer in this box and return immediately to Summit. If you attempt any treachery or fail to comply with our demand as stated, you will never see your boy again. If you pay the money as demanded, he will be returned to you safe and well within 3 hours. These demands are final, and if you do not accede to them, no further communication will be attempted. 2 desperate men." I addressed this letter to Dorset and put it in my pocket. As I was about to start, the kid comes up to me and says,
"Oh, Snake Eye, you said I could play the Black Scout while you were gone."
"Well, play it, of course," says I. "Mr. Bill will play with you. What kind of a game is it?"
"I'm the Black Scout," says Red Chief, "and I have to ride to the stockade to warn the settlers that the Indians are coming. I'm tired of playing Indian myself. I want to be the Black Scout."
"All right," says I. "It sounds harmless to me. I guess Mr. Bill will help you foil the pesky savages."
"Well, what am I to do?"
asked Bill, looking at the kid suspiciously.
"You are the hoss," says Black Scout. "Get down on your hands and knees. How can I ride to the stockade without a hoss?"
"You better keep him interested," says I, "till we get the scheme going. Loosen up."
Bill gets down on all fours, and a look comes in his eye like a rabbit's when you catch it in a trap.
"How far is it to the stockade, kid?"
he asked in a husky manner of voice.
90 miles, says the Black Scout, "and you have to hump yourself to get there on time. Whoa, now!"
The Black Scout jumps on Bill's back and digs his heels in his side.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," says Bill. "Hurry back, Sam, as soon as you can. I wish we hadn't made the ransom more than 1,000. Say, you quit kicking me, or I'll get up and warm you good."
I walked over to Poplar Cove and sat down around the post office and store, talking with the Chawbacons that came in to trade. One Whiskerand says that he hears Summit is all upset on account of Elder Ebenezer Dorset's boy having been lost or stolen. That was all I wanted to know. I bought some smoke and tobacco, referred casually to the price of black-eyed peas, posted my letter surreptitiously, and came away. The postmaster said the mail carrier would come by in an hour to take the mail on to Summit. When I got back to the cave, Bill and the boy were not to be found. I explored the vicinity of the cave and risked a yodel or two, but there was no response. So I lighted my pipe and sat down on a mossy bank to await developments. In about 30 minutes, I heard the bushes rustle, and Bill wobbled out into the little glade in front of the cave. Behind him was the kid, stepping softly like a scout, with a broad grin on his face. Bill stopped, took off his hat, and wiped his face with a red handkerchief. The kid stopped about 8 feet behind him.
"Sam," says Bill, "I suppose you'll think I'm a renegade, but I couldn't help it. I'm a grown person with masculine proclivities and habits of self-defense, but there is a time when all systems of egotism and predominance fail.
The boy is gone. I have sent him home. All is off. There was martyrs in old times, goes on Bill, that suffered death rather than give up the particular graft they enjoyed. None of them ever was subjugated to such supernatural tortures as I have been. I tried to be faithful to our articles of depredation, but there came a limit. What's the trouble, Bill? I asked him. I was rode, says Bill, the 90 miles to the stockade, not barring an inch. Then, when the settlers was rescued, I was given oats. Sand ain't a palatable substitute. And then, for an hour, I had to explain to him why there was nothing in holes, how a road could run both ways, and what makes the grass green. I tell you, Sam, a human can only stand so much. I takes him by the neck of his clothes and drags him down the mountain. On the way, he kicks my legs black and blue from the knees down, and I've got 2 or 3 bites of my thumb and hand cauterized. But he's gone, continues Bill. Gone home. I showed him the road to Summit and kicked him about 8 feet nearer there in one kick. I'm sorry we lose the ransom, but it was either that or Bill Driscoll to the madhouse.
Bill is puffing and blowing, but there is a look of ineffable peace and growing content in his rose-pink features. Bill, says I, there ain't any heart disease in your family, is there?
No, says Bill. Nothing chronic, except malaria and accidents. Why?
Then you might turn around, says I, and have a look behind you. Bill turns and sees the boy and loses his complexion and sits down plump on the ground and begins to pluck aimlessly at grass and little sticks. For an hour I was afraid for his mind, and then I told him that my scheme was to put the whole job through immediately and that we would get the ransom and be off with it by midnight if old Dorset fell in with our proposition. So Bill braced up enough to give the kid a weak sort of a smile and a promise to play the Russian in a Japanese war with him as soon as he felt a little better. I had a scheme for collecting that ransom without danger of being caught by counterplots that ought to commend itself to professional kidnappers. The tree under which the answer was to be left, and the money later on, was close to the road fence with big bare fields on all sides. If a gang of constables should be watching for anyone to come for the note, they could see him a long way off crossing the field or in the road. But no siree. At 8:30, I was up in that tree, as well hidden as a tree toad, waiting for the messenger to arrive. Exactly on time, a half-grown boy rides up the road on a bicycle, locates the pasteboard box at the foot of the fence post, slips a folded piece of paper into it, and pedals away again back towards Summit. I waited an hour, and then concluded the thing was square. I slid down the tree, got the note, slipped along the fence till I struck the woods, and was back at the cave in another 30 minutes. I opened the note, got near the lantern, and read it to Bill. It was written with a pen in a crabbed hand, and the sum and substance of it was this. 2 desperate men. Gentlemen, I received your letter today by post in regard to the ransom you ask for the return of my son. I think you are a little high in your demands, and I hereby make you a counter-proposition which I am inclined to believe you will accept. You will bring Johnny home and pay me $250 in cash, and I agree to take him off your hands. You had better come at night, for the neighbors believe he is lost, and I couldn't be responsible for what they would do to anybody they saw bringing him back. Very respectfully, Ebenezer Dorset.
Great pirates of Penzance, says I. Of all the impudent...
But I glanced at Bill, and he hesitated. He had the most appealing look in his eyes I ever saw on the face of a dumb or a talking brute.
Sam, he says, what's $250 after all? We've got the money. One more night of this kid will send me to a bed in Bedlam. Besides, being a thorough gentleman, I think Mr. Dorset is a spendthrift for making us such a liberal offer. You ain't going to let the chance go, are you?
To tell you the truth, Bill, says I, This little he-you lamb has somewhat got on my nerves, too. We'll take him home, pay the ransom, and make our getaway. We took him home that night. We got him to go by telling him that his father had bought a silver-mounted rifle and a pair of moccasins for him, and we were going to hunt bears the next day. It was just 12 o'clock when we knocked at Ebenezer's front door. Just at that moment, when I should have been abstracting the $1,500 from the box under the tree, according to the original proposition, Bill was counting out $250 into Dorset's hand. When the kid found out we were going to leave him at home, he started up a howl like a calliope and fastened himself as tight as a leech to Bill's leg. His father peeled him away gradually, like a porous plaster.
"How long can you hold him?"
asked Bill.
"I'm not as strong as I used to be," says old Dorset, "but I think I can promise you 10 minutes."
"Enough," says Bill. "In 10 minutes I shall cross the central, southern, and middle western states and be legging it trippingly for the Canadian border."
And as dark as it was, and as fat as Bill was, and as good a runner as I am, he was a good mile and a half out of Summit before I could catch up with him. And now, The Marquis and Miss Sally by O. Henry. Without knowing it, old Bill Bascom had the honor of being overtaken by fate the same day as the Marquis of Borodale. The Marquis lived in Regent Square, London. Old Bill lived in Limping Doe Creek, Hardeman County, Texas. The cataclysm that engulfed the Marquis took the form of a bursting bubble known as the Central and South American Mahogany and Caoutchouc Monopoly. Old Bill's nemesis was in the no less perilous shape of a band of civilized Indian cattle thieves from the territory who ran off his entire herd of 400 head and shot old Bill dead as he trailed after them. To even up the consequences of the two catastrophes, the Marquis, as soon as he found that all he possessed would pay only 15 shillings in the pound of his indebtedness, shot himself. Old Bill left a family of 6 motherless sons and daughters who found themselves without even a red steer left to eat, or a red cent to buy one with. The Marquis left 1 son, a young man, who had come to the States and established a large and well-stocked ranch in the panhandle of Texas. When this man learned the news, he'd mounted his pony and rode to town. There he placed everything he owned, except Leeds horse, saddle, Winchester, and $15 in his pocket, in the hands of his lawyers, with instructions to sell and forward the proceeds to London, to be applied toward the payment of his father's debt. Then he mounted his pony and rode southward. One day, arriving about the same time but by different trails, 2 young chaps rode up to the Diamond Cross Ranch on the Little Piedra and asked for work. Both were dressed neatly and sprucely in cowboy costume. One was a straight-set fellow with delicate, handsome features, short brown hair and smooth face, sunburned to a golden brown. The other applicant was stouter and broad-shouldered, with fresh red complexion, somewhat freckled, reddish curling hair, and a rather plain face, made attractive by laughing eyes and a pleasant mouth. The superintendent of the Diamond Cross was of the opinion that he could give them work. In fact, word had reached him that morning that the camp cook, a most important member of the outfit, had straddled his bronco and departed, being unable to withstand the fire of fun and practical jokes of which he was, ex officio, the legitimate target.
"Can either of you cook?" asked the superintendent.
"I can," said the reddish-haired fella, promptly. "I've cooked in camp quite a lot. I'm willing to take the job until you've got something else to offer."
"Now that's the way I like to hear a man talk," said the superintendent approvingly. "I'll give you a note to Saunders, and he'll put you to work."
Thus, the name of John Bascom and Charles Norwood were added to the payroll of the Diamond Cross. The two left for the Roundup camp immediately after dinner. Their directions were simple but sufficient.
"Keep down the arroyo for 15 miles till you get there."
Both being strangers from afar, young-spirited, and thus thrown together by chance for a long ride, it is likely that the comradeship that afterward existed so strongly between them began that afternoon as they meandered along the little valley of the Canada Verde. They reached their destination just after sunset. The main camp of the roundup was comfortably located on the bank of a long waterhole under a fine motte of timber. A number of small tents pitched upon grassy spots, and the big wall tent for provisions showed that the camp was intended to be occupied for a considerable length of time. The roundup had ridden in but a few moments before, hungry and tired, to a supperless camp. The boys were engaged in an emulous display of anathemas supposed to fit the case of the absconding cook. While they were unsaddling and hobbling their ponies, the newcomers rode in and inquired for Pink Saunders. The boss of the roundup came forth and was given the superintendent's note. Pink Saunders, though a boss during working hours, was a humorist in camp, where everybody, from cook to superintendent, is equal. After reading the note, he waved his hand toward the camp and shouted ceremoniously at the top of his voice, "Gentlemen, allow me to present to you the Marquis and Miss Sally." At the words, both the new arrivals betrayed confusion. The newly employed cook started, with a surprised look on his face, but immediately recollecting that Miss Sally is the generic name for the male cook in every West Texas cow camp, he recovered his composure with a grin at his own expense. His companion showed little less discomposure, even turning angrily with a bitten lip, and reached for his saddle pommel, as if to remount his pony. But Miss Sally touched his arm and said laughingly, "Come on now, Marquis. That was quite a compliment from Saunders. It's that distinguished air of yours and aristocratic nose that made him call you that." He began to unsaddle, and the Marquis, restored to equanimity, followed his example. Rolling up his sleeve, Miss Sally sprang for the grub wagon, shouting, "I'm the new cook, by thunder! Some of you chaps rustle up a little wood for a fire, and I'll guarantee you a hot, square meal inside 30 minutes. Miss Sally's energy and good humor, as he ransacked the grub wagon for coffee, flour, and bacon, won the good opinion of the camp instantly. And also, in days following, the Marquis, after becoming better acquainted, proved to be a cheerful, pleasant fellow, always a little reserved and taking no part in the camp frolics. But the boys gradually came to respect this reserve, which fitted the title Saunders had given him, and even to like him for it. Saunders had assigned him to a place holding the herd during the cuttings. He proved to be a skillful rider and as good with the lariat or in the branding pen as most of them. The Marquis and Miss Sally grew to be quite close comrades. After supper was over and everything cleaned up, you would generally find them together, Miss Sally smoking his briar root pipe, and the Marquis plaiting a quirt or scraping rawhide for a new pair of hobbles. The superintendent did not forget his promise to keep an eye on the cook. Several times when visiting the camp, he held long talks with him. He seemed to have taken a fancy to Miss Sally. One afternoon he rode up on his way back to the ranch from a tour of the camps and said to him, "There'll be a man here in the morning to take your place. As soon as he shows up, you come to the ranch. I want you to take charge of the ranch accounts and correspondence. I want somebody that I can depend on to keep things straight while I'm away. The wages will be all right. The Diamond Cross will hold its end up with the man who'll look after its interests." "All right," said Miss Sally, as quietly as if he expected the notice all along. "Any objections to my bringing my wife down to the ranch?"
"You married?" said the superintendent, frowning a little. "You didn't mention it when we were talking."
"Because I'm not," said the cook. "But I'd like to be. Thought I'd wait till I got a job under roof. I couldn't ask her to live in a cow camp."
"Right," agreed the superintendent. "A camp isn't quite the place for a married man, but, well, there's plenty of room at the house, and if you suit us as well as I think you will, you can afford it. You write to her to come on."
"All right," said Miss Sally again. "I'll ride in as soon as I'm relieved tomorrow." It was a chilly night, and after supper the cow punchers were lounging about a big fire of dried mesquite chunks.
Their usual exchange of jokes and repartee had dwindled almost to silence, but silence in a cow camp generally betokens the brewing of mischief. Miss Sally and the Marquis were seated upon a log discussing the relative merits of the lengthened or shortened stirrup in long-distance riding. The Marquis arose presently and went to a tree nearby to examine some strips of rawhide he was seasoning for making a lariat. Just as he left, a little puff of wind blew some scraps of tobacco from a cigarette that Dry Creek Smithers was rolling into Miss Sally's eyes, while the cook was rubbing at them, with tears flowing. Phonograph Davis, so called on account of his strident voice, arose and began a speech. "Fellers and citizens, I desire to propound an interrogatory. What is the most grievous spectacle what a human mind can contemplate?" A volley of answers responded to his question.
"A busted flush.
A maverick when you ain't got your branding iron.
Yourself.
The hole in the end of some feller's gun."
"Shut up, you ignoramuses,"
said old Toller, the fat cowpuncher.
"Phony knows what it is. He's waiting fur to tell us."
"No, fellers and citizens,"
continued Phonograph,
"them spectacles you enumerated air sure grievous, and way up yonder close to the solutions, but they ain't it. The most grievous spectacle air that."
He pointed to Miss Sally, who was still rubbing his streaming eyes.
"A trustin' an inveigled female a weepin' tears on account of her heart being busted by a false deceiver. Air we men or air we catamounts to gaze upon the blightin' of our Miss Sally's affections by an aristocrat? What has come among us with his superior beauty and his glittering title to give the weeps to the lovely critter we are bound to protect? Air we goin' to act like men, or air we goin' to keep an eatin' soggy chuck from her cryin' so plentiful over the bread pan?"
"It's a gallopin' shame," said Dry Creek with a sniffle. "It ain't human. I've noticed the varmint a palaverin' around her frequent, and him a marquis. Ain't that a title, phony?"
"It's something like a king,"
the Brushy Creek kid hastened to explain.
"Only lower in the deck. Guess it comes in between the jack and the ten spot."
"Don't misconstruct me," went on Phonograph, "as undervaluating the aristocrat. Some of 'em are proper people and can travel right along with the Watson boys. I've herded some with them myself. I've viewed the elephant with the mayor of Fort Worth, and I've listened to the owl with the general passenger agent of the Katy, and they can keep up with the procession from where you laid the chunk. But when a marquis monkeys with the innocent affections of a cook lady, may I inquire what the case seems to call for?"
"The leathers,"
shouted Dry Creek Smithers.
"You hearin' 'em, Charity?"
was the kid's form of corroboration.
"We've got your company,"
assented the cowpunchers in chorus. But before the Marquis realized their intention, two of them seized him by each arm and led him up to the log. Phonograph Davis, self-appointed to carry out the sentence, stood ready with a pair of stout leather leggings in his hand. It was the first time they had ever laid eyes on the Marquis during their somewhat rude sports.
"What are you up to?"
he asked indignantly with flashing eyes.
"Go easy, Marquis,"
whispered Rube Fellows, one of the boys that held him.
"It's all in fun. Take it good-natured, and they'll let you off light. They're only going to stretch you over the log and tan you 8 or 10 times with the leggings. 'Twon't hurt much."
The Marquis, with an exclamation of anger, his white teeth gleaming, suddenly exhibited a surprising strength. He wrenched with his arms so violently that the four men were swayed and staggered many yards from the log. A cry of anger escaped him, and then Miss Sally, his eyes clear of the tobacco, saw, and he immediately mixed with the struggling group. But at that moment, a loud
"Hallo!"
rang in their ears, and a buckboard drawn by a team of galloping mustangs spun into the campfire circle of light. Every man turned to look, and what they saw drove from their minds all thought of carrying out Phonograph Davis's rather time-worn contribution to the evening's amusement. Bigger game than the Marquis was at hand, and his captors released him and stood staring at the approaching victim. The buckboard and team belonged to Sam Hawley, a Kankman from the Big Muddy. Sam was driving, and with him was a stout, smooth-faced man wearing a frock coat and a large silk hat. That was the county judge, Mr. Dave Hackett, candidate for re-election. Sam was escorting him about the county, among the camps, to shake up the sovereign voters. The men got out, hitched the team to a mesquite, and walked toward the fire. Instantly, every man in camp, except the Marquis, Miss Sally, and Pink Saunders, who had to play host, uttered a frightful yell of amused terror and fled on all sides into the darkness.
"Heavens alive!" exclaimed Hackett. "Are we as ugly as that? How do you do, Mr. Saunders? Glad to see you again. What are you doing to my hat, Hawley?"
"I was afraid of this hat," said Sam Hawley meditatively. He had taken the hat from Hackett's head and was holding it in his hand, looking dubiously around at the shadows beyond the firelight, where absolute stillness now reigned.
"What do you think, Saunders?"
Pink grinned.
"Better elevate it some," he said,
in the tone of one giving disinterested advice.
"The light ain't none too good. I wouldn't want it on my head."
Hawley stepped upon the hub of a hind wheel of the grub wagon and hung the hat upon a limb of a live oak. Scarcely had his foot touched the ground when the crash of a dozen shooters split the air and the hat fell to the ground, riddled with bullets. A hissing noise was heard as if from a score of rattlesnakes, and now the cowpunchers emerged on all sides from the darkness, stepping high with ludicrously exaggerated caution and hissing to one another to observe the utmost prudence in approaching. They formed a solemn, wide circle about the hat, gazing at it in manifest alarm, and seized every few moments by little stampedes of panicky flight.
"It's the varmint," one said in awed tones, "that flits up and down in the ground at night, saying, 'Willy Walloo!'"
"It's the venomous caputum," proclaimed another. "It stings after it's dead and hollers after it's buried."
"It's the chief of the hairy tribe," said Phonograph Davis. "But it's stone dead now, boys."
"Don't you believe it," demurred Dry Creek. "It's only possumin. It's the dreaded high Golacum Fantod from the forest. There's only one way to destroy its life."
He led forward Old Toller, the 240-pound cowpuncher. Old Toller placed the hat upright on the ground and solemnly sat upon it, crushing it flat as a pancake. Hackett had viewed these proceedings with wide-open eyes. Sam Hawley saw that his anger was rising and said to him,
"Here's where you win or lose, Judge. These are 60 votes on the Diamond Cross. The boys are trying your mettle. Take it as a joke, and I don't think you'll regret it."
And Hackett saw the point and rose to the occasion. Advancing to where the slayers of the wild beast were standing above its remains, and declaring it to be at last defunct, he said, with deep earnestness,
"Boys, I must thank you for this gallant rescue. While driving through the arroyo, that cruel monster that you have fearlessly and repeatedly slaughtered sprang upon us from the treetops. To you I shall consider that I owe my life, and also I hope re-election to the office, for which I am again a candidate. Allow me to hand you my card."
The cowpunchers, always so sober-faced while engaged in their monkey shines, relaxed into a grin of approval. But Phonograph Davis, his appetite for fun not yet appeased, had something more up his sleeve.
"Pardner," he said, addressing Hackett with grave severity, "many a camp would be down on you for turning loose a pernicious varmint like that in it. But being as we all escaped without loss of life, we'll overlook it. You can play square with us if you'll do it."
"How's that?"
asked Hackett suspiciously.
"You're authorized to perform the sacred rites and lefts of matrimony, are you not?"
"Well, yes," replied Hackett.
A marriage ceremony conducted by me would be legal.
A wrong air to be righted in this camp, said Phonograph virtuously. A aristocrat have slighted a humble but beauteous female what's pining for his affections. It's the duty of the camp to drag forth a haughty descendant of 100 or maybe 125 earls. Even so, at the pint of a lariat, and jine him to the weeping lady. Fellas, round up Miss Sally and the Marquis. There's going to be a wedding.
This whim of Phonograph's was received with whoops of appreciation. The cowpuncher started to apprehend the principles of the proposed ceremony.
Kindly prompt me, said Hackett, wiping his forehead, though the night was cool, how far this thing is to be carried. And might I expect any further portions of my raiment to be mistaken for wild animals and killed?
The boys are livelier than usual tonight, said Saunders. The ones they're talking about marrying are two of the boys, a herd rider and the cook. It's another joke. You and Sam will have to sleep here tonight anyway. Perhaps you'd better see him through with it. Maybe they'll quieten down after that.
The matchmakers found Miss Sally seated on the tongue of the grub wagon, calmly smoking his pipe. The Marquis was leaning idly against one of the trees under which the supply tent was pitched. Into this tent they were both hustled, and Phonograph, as master of the ceremonies, gave order for the preparations.
You, Dry Creek, and Jimmy, and Ben, and Toller, hump yourselves into the wild wood and rustle flowers for the blowout. Mesquite'll do, and get that Spanish dagger blossom at the corner of the horse corral for the bride to pack. You, Limpy, get out that red and yaller blanket of yourn for Miss Sally's skirt. Marquis, you'll do thout fixin'. Nobody don't ever look at the groom.
During their absurd preparation, the two principals were left alone for a few moments in the tent. The Marquis suddenly showed wild perturbation. This foolishness must not go on, he said, turning to Miss Sally, a face white in the light of the lantern hanging to the ridgepole.
Why not? Said the cook with an amused smile. It's fun for the boys, and they've always let you off pretty light in their frolics. I don't mind it.
But you don't understand, persisted the Marquis pleadingly. That man is county judge, and his acts are binding. I can't. You don't know.
The cook stepped forward and took the Marquis's hand.
Sally Bascom, he said. I know.
You know? Faltered the Marquis, trembling. And you want to?
More than I ever wanted anything. Will you?
Here come the boys.
The cowpunchers crowded in, laden with armfuls of decorations.
Perfidious count, said
Phonograph sternly, addressing the Marquis.
Are ye willing to patch up the damage you did this here slab-sided but trustin' bunch of calico by single foot and easy to the altar? Or will we have to rope ye and drag ye thar?
The Marquis pushed back his hat and leaned jauntily against some high-piled sacks of beans. His cheeks were flushed and his eyes shining.
Go on with the rat-killin', said he.
A little while after, a procession approached the tree under which Hackett, Hawley, and Saunders were sitting smoking. Limpy Walker was in the lead, extracting a doleful tune from his concertina. Next came the bride and groom. The cook wore the gorgeous Navajo blanket tied around his waist, and carried in one hand the waxen-white Spanish dagger blossom, as large as a peck measure and weighing 15 pounds. His hat was ornamented with mesquite branches and yellow retama blooms. A resurrected mosquito net served as a veil. After them stumbled Phonograph Davis, in the character of the bride's father, weeping into a saddle blanket with sobs that could be heard a mile away. The cowpunchers followed by twos, loudly commenting upon the bride's appearance, in a supposed imitation of the audiences at fashionable weddings. Hackett rose as the procession halted before him, and after a little lecture upon matrimony, asked,
"What are your names?"
"Sally and Charles," answered the cook. Join hands, Charles and Sally. Perhaps there never was a stranger wedding, for wedding it was, though only two of those present knew it. When the ceremony was over, the cowpunchers gave one yell of congratulation and immediately abandoned their foolery for the night. Blankets were unrolled, and sleep became the paramount question. The cook, divested of his decorations, and the Marquis lingered for a moment in the shadow of the grub wagon. The Marquis leaned her head against his shoulder. "I didn't know what else to do," she was saying. "Father was gone, and we kids had to rustle. I had helped him so much with the cattle that I thought I'd turn cowboy. There wasn't anything else I could make a living at. I wasn't much stuck on it, though, after I got here, and I'd have left only..."
"Only what?"
"You know. Tell me something. When did you first... What made you..."
"Oh, it was as soon as we struck the camp, when Saunders bawled out, 'The Marquis and Miss Sally.' I saw how rattled you got at the name, and I had my..."
"Cheeky," whispered the Marquis. "And why should you think that I thought he was calling me Miss Sally?"
"Because," answered the cook calmly, "I was the Marquis. My father was the Marquis of Borrowdale. But you'll excuse that, won't you, Sally? It really isn't my fault, you know."
And there's our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Ransom of Red Chief and The Marquis and Miss Sally by O. Henry. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.